thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Hey everyone, Vincent Aiello, call sign Jello, and this week on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, we're trying something different. We're airing an authentic media snapshot, as we call it. It's a portion of one of the shows that are military aviation based from our friends over at Authentic Media. I think you're going to enjoy it. Here we go.
I've got the other one. Select Fox 2. Shoot him. I don't got a cone.
Get the second one.
I got the second one on the nose right now.
Hey, I'm high cover on you.
Get a Fox. Get a Rocky Mouse. Just lock him up. Hey, shoot him, Fox 2.
I can't.
I don't have a fucking cone. So what? Good kill, good kill.
Hey, good kill.
This is Authentic.
We're welcome to the beginning of Authentic's episode on the AIM-9 missile. I'm Scott Roger Chafee, and I'm here with Brian Sunshine Sinclair. Pardon me. How you doing, Sunshine?
Doing well, Roger. I enjoyed our little back and forth there, and I guess we could roll up our sleeves and get into it if you like.
Let's get into it, because we're here to talk about the AIM-9, better known as the Sidewinder. And I think it needs little introduction, but Brian, I'm just going to toss right over to you. You know, let's talk about how we got to what is very possibly today the premier within visual range infrared missile in the world.
Sure thing. And let me back up. So, you know, I did some operational tours in the F-18, but
sure.
And I respected the AIM-9, and we flew with the AIM-9 Mike and X, and we'll get into those variants, if you will, in the discussion later. But I didn't really have the thorough appreciation or really the thorough background knowledge to fully appreciate the Sidewinder until I got my VX-31 test tour in China Lake in Ridgecrest, California. So,
right.
And that was because that is the home of the Sidewinder, right?
Okay.
And so as I learned more about Dr. William McLean, the kind of father of the Sidewinder and the iterations it went through, it just, I kind of geeked out, I'll be honest with you, and it became a very fascinating story of kind of technical ingenuity as well as operational application. All right. And I'll step through that to explain exactly what I mean by that. But there's some novel concepts that were built into this thing that hadn't been seen before. Some of them were passive designs, meaning it doesn't take electricity, doesn't take any kind of logic. It just happens naturally just by pretty much harnessing physics to do what you want to do. And we'll get into rollerons and we'll talk about that. But anyway, so there's a lot of just ingenuity, we'll say, that went into that. And but this program actually started with the Germans, and that's kind of lending to your point of the segue from Star Wars or Andor, really, right? So think Germany, World War II, they have their buzz bombs, right? So there's V1, V2, there are a couple other V bombs anyway, and the V I think was vengeance, if that sounds right.
But yeah, that's correct.
Point being is they wanted to, instead of just having it fly a certain trajectory and hit whatever was available, they thought, well, what if we actually designated targets, heat sensing or heat sources, excuse me, on the ground? What if we had a way to sense the source and then go ahead and cue the missile or really guide the missile into its target? So they had a Project Hamburg, it was called. So the German scientists there are working on an IR sensor, an IR tracker, whatever you want to call it. And we'll talk about their rudimentary design that actually was incorporated into the early Sidewinders using a spinning filter, if you will. But they went from there. They basically matured the system as much as it could be as a sensor, but they had yet to integrate it into any of their missiles or their buzz bomb, excuse me, to become a missile.
Right.
And so, and then the war ended. So the war ended, obviously, hooray to the Allies, right? So some of the German scientists, the high-ranking military officials, the technical officers, if you will, they had a choice, go to jail, get shot, or, you know, come over to the U.S. and help us, right? So the Allies ended up divvying up a lot of the technical expertise, right, as well as the technical files or records. And over here, do you remember we had Operation Paperclip?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
I do.
Right. So we brought over Wernher von Braun, I think, is a great example of Operation Paperclip, right? Bringing over rocket technology that NASA, originally NASA is going to use to help us with our space race, if you will. Mm-hmm. So besides that, though, the German engineers came over and that Hamburg project technology, we'll call it, landed in Dr. William McLean's lap in Ridgecrest, California. Back, it was called NOTS, right? Naval Ordnance Test Station, which later becomes NAWS, Naval Air Weapons Station, China Lake. Same spot in Ridgecrest there. And he starts off with a little bit of side money kind of thing. And it's more of a side project, actually, kind of a garage project. And what he wants to do is he's hoping to take are you familiar with Zuni rockets?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's indeed a rocket, right? So you just kind of fire it and the ballistics are going to make it land wherever it lands, whether it be wind or whatever affects it. So now he wanted to turn a rocket into a missile. And hopefully folks at home know the difference between the two, right?
I'll take the layman point of view. If you guide a rocket, it turns into a missile, right?
Nailed it. That's exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. So Dr. McLean was hoping to take a Zuni rocket and make it become an IR missile. Mm-hmm. And so they went through some iterations, if you will. And as it turned out, he was successful with it. And it's to the point that as he's working through this, they're trying to figure out the technology and how to integrate it into a weapon. And they, as you can imagine, they start getting more and more money because it seems to be going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they start to get some test pilots that are going to help with the test and evaluation portion of it. And does the name Wally Schirall sound familiar at all?
Just vaguely from something about, from moonshots in NASA. Yeah.
There you go. Good old Mercury 7 days, right? Yeah. So it turns out Wally Schirall was actually one of the Sidewinder test pilots.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to start attaching some years to everything, if you will, to kind of put it into perspective. So in 1946, Dr. William McLean gets the information and starts his garage project on the on the Sidewinder itself.
Right.
And then in 1950, they actually came up with the name Sidewinder. And Roger, do you have any idea why they called it a Sidewinder?
Well, I think I do. And you can tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is at the time, guidance is probably the wrong term, but I'm going to say guidance. The guidance system was such that it was an absolute command to the flap or the aileron. It either went hard left or hard right to make its corrections. So it would either go hard left, hard right, and it would sort of, what's the word, sidewind through the sky. So they named it after the snake. At least that's how I heard the story.
Yeah, that's true. It did duplicate kind of the helical fashion. So think Ridgecrest, California. We're talking California high desert, lots of wind, lots of dust, lots of heat, right? So you got the Sidewinder. You got the rattlesnakes out there, one of which is the Sidewinder, and he does his curlicue motion. So you're spot on there. The other thing is rattlesnakes, they have IR sensing organs basically on their lips, and they use that to track and to pounce on prey. Mm-hmm. So Dr. McLean was thinking, well, here's an IR weapon that's going to go pounce on something based on an IR signature. So there's a commonality there. So let's call it the Sidewinder. And so
I didn't know that last part. I knew about the rattlesnake. I didn't know the time there. That's awesome. I'll do a little editorial aside to say, so here's the difference between a test pilot and a SWO, right? A SWO says, just that sort of lefty right thing. And the test pilot goes helical. So yeah, there we go.
Oh yeah, sorry, dude. Well, but you know what, so in these discussions that that kind of semantics, the word choice, diction, whatever, can sometimes serve me well, but where it doesn't serve me well is at the dinner table, and I'm trying to relay a story to my girls and my wife, and they're rolling their eyes like, dude, who talks like that, you know what I'm saying? There's a fine line, and I'm still trying to find it. You know what I'm saying?
All good, man. I think we're all works in progress, especially as we, 20 plus years trying to transition to civilian life. It's never actually going to happen. But anyway, I'm sorry for the digression. Proceed.
This is all good. This is all good. So kind of snapping back to the timeline. So you're looking at the early 50s. They call it Sidewinder, and then Sidewinder 1 actually in 1952, and then in 52 also they had the first live fire.
Okay.
So they launched it. I'm not sure if Wally Schirall was the pilot or not, but anyway. And then I think that was September. And then a couple of days later, it was actually September 11th of 1952, the first Sidewinder shoots down the first drone in over U.S. soil. So it's not, wow. It's out of curiosity, right? They shot it out of curiosity, mm-hmm. not out of anger.
Yeah.
So no combat right now. We're just doing test and evaluation, right? Developmental right. test and evaluation. Yeah. So the course of the next couple of years out to spanning about 54, they have about 51 test launches and they go mm-hmm. very well to the point that the government and basically the stakeholders say, you know what, this is a worthwhile investment. Let's go ahead and start production. So in mm-hmm. 1955, they start production. And then in 1956, its initial operational capability, its IOC, is with the U.S. Navy, and they're going to strap mm-hmm. it to Grumman F-9Fs as well as the FJ-3 Furies.
Right.
And the intent, the CONEMP, the concept of employment, is actually for these Navy fighters to be able to shoot down long-range bombers. Mm-hmm. So non-maneuvering, relatively slow traveling, if you will, but high right. altitude, right? Bombers. Mm-hmm. So just keep that in mind as we kind of progress through the target sets, starting out with something big, slow, ugly, right. hanging up high. And eventually we're going to get in the 9X where you can shoot it off bore sight, right?
Right.
So you can shoot a guy basically off your left or right wings. Yeah.
yeah. So. Worth remembering that these missiles, all missiles were originally seen as that sort of large, slow target counter, you know, guns were still going to be used at that point for anything maneuvering.
Yes. And you bring up a great point. So fantastic segue into the first combat experience of the Sidewinder. Remember, mm-hmm. it's still not an AIM-9 yet. It's called the Sidewinder.
Right.
And that's going to be good old the Chinese Communist Party in mainland mm-hmm. China are fighting the Chinese nationalists mm-hmm. who are on Taiwan, which
right.
probably sounds like a lot, you know, the tensions we're all the way.
More things late... change.
Yeah.
The more exactly. they stay the same. Right.
That's so true. Yeah. So from the late 50s until now, there's mm-hmm. been tension and kind of plans for the Chinese Communist Party to reunify, right, mm-hmm. Taiwan. So back then, though, they had actual open hostilities, if you will.
Right.
And the Chinese Communist Party, so the mainland China, we'll just call them, they had MiG-17s, mm-hmm. whereas the nationalists had F-86s. And if you were to compare and contrast the performance of both, you're going to see that the F-86 really doesn't have a snowball's chance against the MiG-17.
Right.
So MiG-17.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, the MiG-17 took all of the lessons learned from the MiG-15 fighting the F-86 in Korea, right?
Correct.
So it's you're up against the plane that was designed to be better than you.
Correct. That's 120% yeah. correct. Yeah. So basically now, I don't want to say freedom of navigation, but the MiG-17s have unfettered transit of the strait there. So, mm-hmm. you know, between Taiwan and mainland China, you've got used to be called the Formosa Strait. Now it's the Strait of right. Taiwan, whatever you want to call it. And it's a min distance, I think, was just about 100 nautical miles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a narrow body of water. Anyway, these MiG-17s would just be high fast flyers and they go pretty much right over top of the F-86s. And the F-86s at one time only had guns, so they couldn't right. pitch up, shoot them, and they just, there was nothing they could do. So the MiGs would just run high and fast and completely leave the F-86s in the dust. And all that was true, and the U.S. noticed that, and they had something called Operation Black Magic. Is there a chance you've heard of that?
I'm not familiar with Black Magic, no.
Okay.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
So the U.S. said, well, why don't we give the Taiwanese a little edge up, right? A little leg up, mm-hmm. excuse me, on the competition. So they brought over the Sidewinders and it was a black project. So not well known, obviously. They integrated them onto the F-86 and then they trained mm-hmm. the F-86 pilots on how to employ them.
OK, I knew that. I didn't know the name was Black Magic. OK, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So way back time machine again, we're looking at September 24th, 1958. There are six or more MiG-17s flying high and fast east. So from mainland China over to Taiwan, the F-86s are below them. Well, little do they know, the F-86s are armed with these Sidewinders. So the F-86s end up loosing six Sidewinders. They go up and they hit four of the MiG-17s. So splash four MiG-17s. The other remaining MiG-17s kind of get in dogfights, but no one else is really taken out by a missile. And then they go their separate ways. Mm-hmm. And it became this. So the Sidewinder basically was a wake-up call to the Chinese, we'll call them the Chinese communists, And it became a deterrent weapon. So I know traditionally we kind of think of deterrent weapons being a nuclear weapon of some sort, right?
Right.
But back in the late 50s, the deterrent weapon was actually the Sidewinder, and it kept the MiG-17s out of Taiwanese airspace.
Right.
So six missiles were shot, four aircraft were shot down. But it turned out on that first day of the first combat, the 24th of September, 1958, one of the weapons, one of the other two that didn't shoot down a plane actually hit a plane, but it didn't go high order. So it dudded. Mm-hmm. So it stayed embedded in the MiG-17. The MiG-17 pilot was able to successfully recover the plane and the missile back in communist China. And then they basically popped it out, popped the weapon or the missile out of the plane and sent it back to Russia. Mm-hmm. And the Soviet engineers reverse engineered it. And they were, and some quotes I read about, they were absolutely stunned by the innovation of the Sidewinder missile, both in the seeker as well as the passive dynamic systems on board that we'll talk about.
Right.
And they came up kind of with their shameless duplicate, if you will. They called it the K-13, but for us, the NATO designator is the AA-2 ATOL.
Right.
Does that sound familiar at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the Soviets were, you know, never terrific at innovation in a lot of areas, but terrific at reverse engineering.
They were. Yes, they were. Especially given the motivation. I know Stalin used to tell them, hey, you will make an exact replica of this captured American weapon or I will kill you. So
yeah,
the,
I mean,
motivation
that's
high.
That's motivation. Yeah,
that's definitely motivation. They weren't worried about days off or.
That's
or
right. Oh or man, is Shine going to get this promotion or am I going to get it? I don't know. Oh no, I'm going
to
get shot if this doesn't go well.
Exactly. So the stakes were high. We'll say that,
yes.
Right? For the Russian engineers there. So, all right, cool. So basically, the inaugural combat display, we'll say, of the weapon. Actually, one of the weapons fell in enemy hands. So then they worked on the Soviets worked on their version, the AA-2 ATOL. And it turned out to be a pretty, on their side, we'll say, a very successful weapon also. So diving back a little bit. So through this evolution, we'll talk about the 12 different variants, but over the next three decades, right, it's probably, just like you said earlier, Scott, it's the most influential heat-seeking missile that the U.S. has, and consequently the Eastern Bloc or Soviet Union countries have too. For us, there were about 110,000 Sidewinders that were produced during those three decades, those 3 years.
Wow.
And they were used by the U.S. as well as 27 partner nations. And so so it was definitely a success story. And then if you don't mind, we'll jump back into the timeline. So we
talked
about 1958, right? And the Chinese communists there getting scared, if you will. And then from there, in 1965, so it was also the year that we joined Vietnam, right?
Right.
But the Sidewinder missile program was renamed to the AIM-9. Mm-hmm. So basically from 46 when it started until 65, it was called the Sidewinder, and then it became the AIM-9. So you got the AIM-9, and then they started working on variants. The next instance of being shot in anger or combat ops, is going to be India versus Pakistan, and they're fighting over Kashmir,
right?
Which is heavily Once contested
again,
environment. Yeah,
the more things change.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. And so this time we backed the Pakistanis, and they had F-104s. So we put AIM-9s on the 104s, and they enjoyed a very nice success rate. We'll say, and we call it P sub K, so probability of kill.
Right.
So yeah, so the P sub K was pretty high for that. And that would be 65. And at the same time, so, you know, Vietnam, the war started in 1955, but the U.S. joined, if you will, in 1965, right? So about 10 years later into it.
Yeah.
And then we started using the AIM-9s on our aircraft, predominantly our F-4s, right? Our Phantoms.
Right.
It was joined by the Air Force and the Navy. Unfortunately, though, the results were less than stellar. So they looked at, and it's hard to catch numbers, especially in combat, you know, because it's just the reporting is very difficult, as you could imagine. Sure. But they took a snapshot from 1965 to 1968. They had launched 452 Sidewinders, and the U.S. Navy enjoyed 46 downed aircraft, and the Air Force enjoyed 34 downed aircraft. So in other words, shooting down bad guy aircraft, right?
Right.
And so when you look at that little number over a big number, that's a ratio, that's going to be your probability of kill. It turns out the probability of kill in Vietnam was about 16 to 18%.
Right.
So it's kind of in the
dumps. Not super.
No, not super at all. Not super at all. So they decided, hey, let's try some different variants of this. Besides an IR seeker, what if we went like with the AIM-9 Charlie? We'll use a radar variant. We'll see how we can mix it up. So there was a lot of tinkering, if you will. And then the next major combat action was 1982, and that would be the Falklands War. Mm-hmm. Does that kind of sound familiar? Remember who fighting there?
That would be, you said the Falklands. I may consider it the Malvinas, but in which case it would be Argentina fighting Great Britain. But for the Falklands, it's Great Britain fighting Argentina.
There you go. Well played. I like that. Yeah. Well played indeed. Yeah, so the Brits had their Harriers, right, the Sea Harriers. Mm-hmm. And then we strapped AIM-9s, or really they strapped AIM-9s to them, and they ended up shooting down a whole bunch of Argentinian Super Entendeur, so the Super E, the French fighter, right, as well, or more of an attack, I guess, as well as the Skyhawks. So the Argentinians had the A4 Skyhawk, and they had the Super E. So, and the P-sub-K, the probability of kill, went from, in Vietnam, about 16-18%, went up to 82%. So much, much better. So like, oh, okay, hold on. Yeah. So, you know, the missile that was kind of looking like a good idea, and then Vietnam proved it otherwise, and now the Falklands are saying, hey, this actually is a very viable weapon. Mm-hmm. And so that was in 82. And then, let's see, most recently, most folks probably remember in 2017, do you remember there was a, unfortunately, it was an air-to-air miss initially, but a lieutenant, by a U.S. Navy lieutenant commander, actually, I think it was MOB, as his call sign, and he tried to shoot down a fitter, a Syrian SU-22 fitter. Yeah, so he used an AIM-9, I think it was AIM-9X, because he was in theater, and unfortunately it was decoyed by the flares, the Soviet flares, so then they ended up, he consummated the intercept with an AIM-120.
Right.
Yeah.
So, as we look back at this, and if you want to talk about this in a different tangent or a different phase, that's fine, but we can do it now. So, you know, we see some early, I think, obviously, the Taiwanese and the Chinese, there's an element of surprise. And usually any weapon that is technically viable works really well when you have that first element of surprise. And then the Pakistanis do well against the Indians, especially, you know, coming from a fighter that's not generally considered a great dogfighter, right? The F-104, real fast, in a straight line. Yeah, doesn't turn super well.
No.
And then we have, you know, a sort of horrible experience in Vietnam with that and with the Sparrow. And then the Brits come back. So how much of that is variant? How much of that is training? How much of that is circumstance? And by circumstance or training. So, for example, when I was talking in another interview with an early model F-16 pilot, and you may get to this, but I did not realize that there were essentially two seeker tones, and you can hear that in our intro to the show earlier with some audio provided by Sunshine. Sure. I didn't realize there were two seeker tones, one that said the missile says, I see the target. And then the missile says, well, I have enough to now lock onto the target. So what changed? Was it technology? Was it training?
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Thanks for listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast and this Authentic Media snapshot. If you like what you heard, head over to Authentic Media on your favorite podcast platform for complete episodes and a whole lot more. We'll see you next time. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a Yellow Ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.